Yes, it is. Israel is still in a political deadlock, but this time there is a game changer in the way that the main competition will be between two right-wingers. And the only question is who of both of them, Benjamin Netanyahu or Gideon Saar, will be the next prime minister. Both are very tough nationalists and right-wingers, and it's not good news for Israel. But right now they are the two only candidates with chances, obviously. Not a possible government. I mean, it was a big government with very little agreements, and above all, personal things were the main issue, mainly the charges against the prime minister. And you cannot run a country, especially not in times of corona, you cannot run a country with such a government. I mean, it was very clear that this government cannot function. Above all, Prime Minister Netanyahu, I mean, he takes the responsibility. In the last years, it's not really government, because Netanyahu does whatever he wants. He really became a one-show man, for the good and for the bad, and all the responsibility is on his shoulder. For the good and for the bad, the good things that happen to Israel, the bad things that happen to Israel, they are right now all Netanyahu, because he doesn't let anyone else really to run any kind of independent policy.
One of the pivotal moments in Israel was the so-called deal of the century. Of course, it failed, but it had huge repercussions for the native Arab population of Israel. The so-called deal of the century will only impact the indigenous Arab population in Israel. The so-called deal would have made hundreds of thousands of them lose their citizenships and would change the status of their communities. It would make their neighborhoods a Palestinian enclave, cut off from the neighboring occupied West Bank by an Israeli barrier known as the Apartheid Wall. The so-called deal would put over 300,000 of them at risk of being transferred out of their ancestral home of pre-1948 occupied Palestine. So far, this won't happen, but it's not a new plot. Israel has been working on this since 1948. The population has been vocal this year over that and Israel's discriminatory and apartheid tactics against them. They believe that Israel wants them out. At least according to the debt deal of the century, Israel wanted to isolate them, to make them apart from the occupied territories. The population represents over 20% of Israel, and Tel Aviv feels threatened by them.
It could be in a practice, yes. For our generation, it's another Nakba. It's a sort of Nakba for our community. First of all, we have extended the lands all over the country, and not just in our residential areas. So as part of the Palestinian people, we have extended historical rights that we are demanding. Many of us here in the Triangle are uprooted Palestinians, which means that they are internally displaced citizens. Our original villages were destroyed back in 48 during the Nakba. We are still demanding, and we will continue to demand returning to our destroyed villages like El Lajon and El Zinat and El Kafrin. And this demand basically will be impossible if they implement this transfer. So maybe the idea is not to uproot us from our homes, but it's definitely to uproot us from our historical lands and to deny our right in these lands. So for us, this is an important issue. I believe that Netanyahu included this provision about the transfer of the Arab community of the Triangle in advance of the election as part of his campaign against Arab citizens and against the joint list, the political representative of Arab citizens in Israel. Netanyahu knows that we are influential and that our votes affect the national map in Israel and could affect who will be the prime minister in Israel. This is the reason why he is trying to weaken our struggle, to weaken our political maneuver and the political activity. And part of that is basically to have less Arabs and basically to have less voters and less representatives in the Knesset. This is a clearly racist motivation. Netanyahu is very worried about our gradually influential role within Israeli politics.
A recent video on social media shows Israeli Arabs walking around in Tel Aviv pretending to be Emirates, while Israelis waited in line to be photographed with them. In fact, they were trying to show how welcoming Israelis were towards Emirates, while discriminating against the original people of the land. On social media, the conversation was tense. Abir says it's almost like Israelis aren't racist against Arabs. Mujib says this is the Palestinian town inside the Green Line, where the Israeli military massacred scores of defenseless Muslim civilians during the Suez War of 1956.
The deal of the century is there to serve Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. It is about the Jews, it's about the Israelis. It turns a blind eye to the Palestinians, to the plight, to their cause. And it is hardly a surprise that it didn't find many enthusiasts among the Palestinians. However, it was very useful in conveying the most important message to the Palestinians, that the Americans are not a negotiator, they are a side in this conflict.
No, it's dead together with Donald Trump, who is leaving the White House within 2 weeks. Nobody really took it seriously. There are those few agreements with four Arab states, which I don't want to underestimate. They have some value, but this is not the deal of the century, because the deal of the century was about to solve also the Palestinian issue, which is the main issue, and the Palestinian problem was not even touched. And therefore, we better forget about the deal of the century, and we will see what will the next administration offer, but I have no expectation.
Israel is in a political deadlock. However, politically and ideologically and unethically, they are more united than ever. What they really don't agree is to be ruled by Netanyahu, but in terms of their right-wing commitment, they are actually extremely united, and the left has evaporated into total nothingness. Israel failed to make changes because the Israeli political system in the last few years is not there to serve the Israelis, but one, to serve oligarchs around the world, two, to save Netanyahu from the legal complications inflicted on himself. He's doing the best he can to save himself, but he has found out that at least within the political system, he has a growing number of opponents. However, the Israeli public still support him and will support a government under his leadership. They like him.
According to the report by the Latet nonprofit, the portion of Israeli households living in poverty rose from 20.1% to 29.3% in 2020. This while the regime in Israel continues to ignore the issue, according to Israeli media. Israelis in general believe that Netanyahu is after saving himself from jail time, as he is accused of corruption and has a pending trial. Meanwhile, protests that have been taking place every week and sometimes every day for almost a year now are growing. Some believe that Israel is on the brink of an uprising that may reshape Israel forever. For now, 2020 is ending, but the crises faced by Israelis and Israel in general continue. Here is the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. A new survey conducted by the Abraham Initiatives has found that most Arab Israelis, 58%, would participate in the Israel protest movement against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if it highlighted ongoing issues facing the community, such as the economic situation and housing. Likewise, almost three-fourths, 73%, support the goals of the protest movement. I-24 News. UAE set to have suspended tourist visas for Israeli travelers. Several hundred Israeli passengers who landed in Dubai recently were denied entry into the United Arab Emirates, Israeli media report. According to the reports, the incident, which saw only Israelis holding other passports as well to enter, was caused by a change in the Emirati visa policy. Times of Israel. Israeli War Minister Benny Gantz warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on that he would not be Prime Minister again if Israel goes to a fourth election in 2 years, and once again urged him to pass the 2020 budget. Ynet News. At least 25 people were arrested in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds as police clashed with thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews protesting the construction of a light railway line passing through their neighborhoods. A light railway line is set to go through the Bar Ilan area, with opponents saying it could disrupt the bus services and bring indecent behavior into the religious community.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام الصدقة يوم الجمعة تضاعف لفضل يوم الجمعة على غيره من الأيام.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The charity giving on Friday is considered double because of the superiority of Friday over other days."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing and a honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, talking about one of the most interesting conversations, the most interesting dialogues which I have seen in a long time, deals with a conversation between Jabir al-Jawfi, one of the companions and knowledgeable students of Imam al-Baqir, and of course Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam himself. Now, in this conversation between the two, these high moral standards, these spiritual wisdoms are exchanged and are given to Jabir al-Jawfi, which truly, if we are able to implement them in our lives, can not only change our lives for the better, but truly they can perfect humanity. Now, during this conversation, at one point, Imam al-Baqir says to Jabir, "There are no riches better than the riches of the soul." It's interesting, but as this conversation goes towards the end of the dialogue, we find that the statements become much smaller, but the depth of meanings becomes truly much greater. And so here, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam tells us that there is no richness, there are no riches, no wealth better than the wealth and the riches of the soul. So what are the riches of the soul? They are the exact opposite to the poverty of the heart. We had said that the poverty of the heart are materialistic desires, the love of materialistic wealth. And here the opposite are the riches of the soul, meaning the good, the proper manners and morals. We call them faza'il of akhlaq, the beauties, the righteousness, the virtues of akhlaq. It is these virtues, dear friends, which are the riches of the soul, the wealth of our soul. We're talking about honesty, sincerity, truthfulness, trust, being kind to one another, helping one another, being good and faithful and obedient servants of Allah, trying to gain Allah's appreciation, for surely it is Allah who has created us and given us existence. And so, as Imam al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, says to Jabir, "There are no riches better than the riches of the soul." A beautiful statement, which comes in this long but profound and life-changing dialogue between Jabir al-Ju'fi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
In another narration, he says, "Kana al-Imam alayhi salam kathir al-buka fi akthar al-awqat khawfan min Allah." Kana kathir al-buka. He used to cry a lot. Why? He fears Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Kana akthar an-nasi tawadhu'an. He was so humble. And humility is the characteristic of a real person. No one can imitate humility, except for a few moments, and then he will forget. People of humility, this characteristic of humility is their gift. And they earn it because they practice it for quite a long time. He kana akthar an-nasi tawadhu'an. Kana askha an-nas. He was so generous, kind. Imam alayhi salam kana yatasaddaqu fi kulli jum'ah. Not only in a normal days, but Fridays, it was a special day for him, like today. He used to give sadaqah every Friday. And he used to say, inna sadaqata yawm al-jum'ah tatadha'af. If you give charity on Friday, it will be manifold, it will increase. Now, when we look at the mawa'idh of Imam salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi, we come to learn, Imam alayhi salam has said, thalathatun min makarimi dunya wal akhira, an ta'fuwa amman zalamak, wa taswila man qata'ak, wa tahluma idha juhila alayk. Three things are the peak of akhlaq in this dunya and the akhirah. Makarim dunya. These are the best akhlaq in this world as well as in the hereafter. He says, number one, forgive the one who wrongs you. It's not easy. Someone wrongs you, you know, you keep it to yourself. You carry it throughout your life. Wherever you see him, you are burn with rage. Yeah, you want to do something bad. But Imam alayhi salam says, no, if you want to be among the people of akhlaq of this world and next, remember to forgive. When you forgive and you don't forget, it will still haunt you. Imam alayhi salam says, an ta'fuwa amman dhalamak. Forgive the one who has wronged you. When you forgive, forget. Because if you don't forget, then it will still come back to you.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community, and that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problems. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, in a famous hadith, said, إن الله تبارك وتعالى أطلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them he chose us. And he chose for us some Shia, some followers. ينصروننا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that work for achieving our goals. Then Amirul Mu'mineen said, "Man adha'a sirrana, adha'ahu Allahu ba's al-hadid." If someone discloses our secrets, Allah will make him taste the pain of iron. It means that he is going to see the attacks of the enemies, the swords and bombs and killings coming from enemies, prison, torture, because he was not careful about keeping the secrets. Okay, now because Amirul Mu'mineen mentioned the point about truthfulness, I move to the other characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, which I promised in the first night that inshallah we are going to expand on that. The community of Ahlul Bayt has to be truthful. Another hadith is from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. لا تغتروا بصلاتهم ولا بصيامهم. You see, there are people who pray, who fast, but don't be deceived. Of course, those who don't pray and don't fast, you know that they are not good people. But those who pray and fast, this doesn't mean that they are from every aspect okay. Why? فَإِنَّ الرَّجُلْ لُبَمَا لَهِجَ بِالصَّلَاةِ وَالصَّوْمِ حَتَّى لَوْ تَرَكَهُ اسْتَوْحَشَ. Sometimes a person has so much said prayer and fasted that it has become a habit. No matter whether he is good or bad, whether he is pious or not, this is the way he has been brought up with. If he doesn't do this, he feels bad. اسْتَوْحَشَ, he feels bad. So question, oh Imam, so how can I find whether someone is good or not? How can I find this person is a good Shia or not? I was thinking by looking at prayer and fasting I can understand. Imam says no, this is not enough. وَلَكِنْ اِخْتَبِرُوهُمْ إِنْدَ صِدْقِ الْحَدِيثِ وَأَدَاءِ الْأَمَانَةِ. Test them. Are they truthful? And are they trustworthy or not? If someone is truthful, is honest, and is trustworthy, he is a good person. Because, you know, it's very difficult to be selfish and be honest. Because those who are selfish, always they want to do something to bring everything towards themselves. All the good things they want to bring. So they cannot remain honest. They have to cheat. They have to tell lies. If you see someone is all the time truthful and trustworthy, then you can be sure that this person has great commitment in his heart to Haqq, to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Another hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
لا تنظروا إلى طول ركوع الرجل وسجوده.
In the previous hadith, Imam said, don't look at fasting and prayer. Here, Imam says, even don't look at the quality of his prayer. Maybe he's the one that he does very nice salat. His ruku takes 3 minutes. Sajda, 5 minutes. Every sajda, 5 minutes. After sajda, half an hour, dua, ta'qibat. Imam says, this is not enough.
لا تنظروا إلى طول ركوع الرجل والسجود فإن ذلك شيء اعتاده.
This has become his habit. He's used to this.
فلو تركه استوحش لذلك.
If he doesn't do this one day, he feels bad. Someone is ill, we have to take him to hospital. He says, no, I have to do my salat. And he, you know, delays you so that you go yourself. Say, okay, I take a taxi, I go. I don't need you to help me. If you are a mu'min, today you have to make your salat faster because we need to take someone to hospital. No, he has become, you know, used to this. He cannot change. فَلَوْ تَرَكَهُ اسْتَوْحَشَ لِذَٰلِكَ وَلَاكِنْ انْظُرُوا إِلَىٰ صِدْقَ حَدِيثِهِ وَأَدَاءِ أَمَانَتِهِ. But look at his truthfulness in his speech and in his trustworthiness. So the community of Ahlul Bayt must be a community which is truthful in all levels. We cannot even tell lies to children. Even to your own children, you cannot tell lies. Even our hadith says, don't tell lies to animals. If you have, for example, I don't know, a horse, don't show him grass, and then when the horse comes to you, then don't give him the grass. This is the level of honesty that our hadith says you should have. Even you cannot deceive a horse. When you give promise, you have to keep it. You know, sometimes people think that giving promise is mustahab, but keeping it is not necessary. So to make you happy, they give you a promise. Easily they keep, you know, giving promising, but they don't keep it. You want something, he says, I will do for you. Then he forgets. This is a very bad habit. Giving promise is not wajib, is not even perhaps mustahab, unless it's a help. But keeping it is wajib. You have to keep your promise. So if you are not sure whether you can keep it, don't give promise, because that person counts on you. And then gradually, people cannot trust anyone. If we give promise, we must make sure that we make a note so that we don't forget, and we do our best to keep our promise.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. O Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin.
رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رائزك
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رائزك لتصي دليلتك once again.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Saeed Bourizza. We'll kick things off here in London, where a court has ruled WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange cannot be extradited to the United States. The judge denied the request for extradition because of concerns over Mr. Assange's mental health and risk of suicide in the U.S. Ahmed Caballo was outside the Old Bailey court.
After months of deliberation, witness statements and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian.
Yes. Yes.
Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
Situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US and internationally, because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling or the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Caballo, London.
Well, and Ahmed Caballo joins me live now for more on that story. Ahmed, you covered a lot of ground in your report. Tell us what the mood was outside the court and also your reaction to today's landmark ruling as you joined fellow journalists to cover today's proceedings.
Well, it was a mixture of euphoria and relief for many of Julian's supporters who were outside the court today. People were crying, people in disbelief, and very few expected the result that was announced shortly after 11 a.m. this morning. But many still feel that the way that Julian was treated, the way that his family was treated, the fact that he was denied visitation rights, denied access to his legal papers, and was not even able to follow the proceedings of his own extradition hearing, was a scandal and something that should not happen in a country that calls itself a democracy, in a country that claims to value freedom of expression and freedom of the press. And many feel that the fact that Julian was treated in this way in itself is enough of a deterrent to stop other people for exposing US war crimes and crimes against humanity, particularly as not a single high-ranking US or UK official or politician has ever stepped foot in a courtroom or been held accountable for those war crimes.
And Ahmed, what do you make of the fact that the judge denied the extradition request based on health grounds?
Yeah, I mean, that is potentially the most worrying part of today's ruling. Of course, it's great news for Julian and his family that he's been, the extradition has been blocked. But the judge essentially agreed with the arguments made by the US prosecutors. So the judge did not take into account that what Julian published was overwhelmingly in the public interest, that the case was politically motivated, that it was taken up by Donald Trump and not taken up by Barack Obama's administration. None of the arguments about freedom of press and the right for journalists to hold governments to account, or for the British and American public to know what their military and government's up to, no. She denied the request on mental health grounds, that if Julian Assange was extradited to the United States, where he'd most likely go to a US supermax prison and be placed under special administrative measures, that it would be serious risk to his life, to him committing suicide, and to his mental health. And so that opens the gate for other journalists to be prosecuted who do not have mental health issues, who want to expose war crimes. And it kind of suggests that field of holding governments to account, of holding US and American military account, is still not open for journalists, and that it was only Julian's mental health that stopped him from being extradited to the United States.
All right, Ahmed Caballo, thank you. Moving on now, the UK is straining every sinew to keep COVID-19 in check as the new variant of the virus blazes through the population. More cases are being announced daily than during the peak of the last lockdown. The daily death toll has shot up as well, so despite the UK being the first to roll out vaccines, many schools will not be opening. Calls for another lockdown are getting louder, but the government is biding its time. Bianca Rahimi tells us more in this report.
The UK's National Health Service is buckling under the pressure. A lack of beds and staff is taking its toll, with people being treated in ambulances queuing outside hospitals. Public health experts are warning it's going to get worse before it gets better.
If you look at the number of COVID patients in hospital beds in London, that has increased by over 45% over the last 8 days. So we are seeing extreme levels of pressure that the NHS hasn't really experienced for a very long time.
The UK government is very proud of being the first country to roll out COVID-19 vaccines. The Pfizer jab on December 8th and the AstraZeneca vaccine on January 4th. More than 1 million Britons have received their first dose, and the government says its target is to vaccinate tens of millions by April. Nonetheless, Downing Street is being accused of dithering and making poor decisions.
I really, really worry about the NHS being overwhelmed, but more importantly, the virus is just going to get a tighter and tighter grip on communities right across the country. And vaccination is not going to come quick enough to help us in that. And it's going to be very, very bad. And the Prime Minister talks about being rough and rocky. It's going to be disastrous if we don't get this under control.
Schools were set to open January 4th, but citing record high infection rates in some areas, many were told to stay closed after the Christmas holidays, giving teachers only days to prepare for online teaching. The government has stopped short of announcing another lockdown, but the opposition says delaying the inevitable will cost lives.
The virus is clearly out of control, and there's no good the Prime Minister hinting that further restrictions are coming to place in a week or two or three. That delay has been the source of so many problems. So I say bringing those restrictions now, national restrictions, within the next 24 hours. That has to be the first step to controlling the virus.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson says there is no question that tougher restrictions are needed and that they will be announced in due course. This comes after the health secretary admitted the tier system was not strong enough to deal with the new variant, which spreads much faster. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Let's get some thoughts on that story. Limbed Opik is a former MP and political commentator joining me now. It's good to have you with us. So it's been described as chaos and confusion. Not the first time we're hearing that as people return from the Christmas period. Your assessment of what we're witnessing?
Well, those two words are accurate. It's been chaotic because the government has not really given a very clear steer. And as you heard in that report, they delay the decision making, and that leads to the confusion. The public has been very obedient, very cooperative for almost a year now, and they're getting rather fed up. So the real danger here is, even if the government thinks it knows what it's doing, the public don't think the government knows what it's doing. And I've met politicians who live in Tier 4, and they don't even understand those rules. How on earth is anything going to get simpler if they're going to further complicate the system?
Let's dig deeper into the dithering on the part of the government. What it claims to do is it's following the science when it suits them, but then they consistently delay and then perform U-turns. How long can this go on for?
Well, they've performed so many U-turns that it's turned into a circle. And when they say they follow the science, one has to conclude that, in their view, the science keeps changing. Well, the difficulty here is the frustration that it creates, a nervous and an uncomfortable public that's been told repeatedly that this is a lethal weapon and we have to be responsible with it. If the public don't have faith in the government, then the government can't have faith that the public's going to follow that. And what this all adds up to is this kind of delay and really the feeling that the government has lost control, and that lack of confidence in the government is in itself likely to cause people to make their own rules up. And if those rules happen to be less than ideal in terms of this new variant of COVID-19, then the disease will carry on spreading.
One final question very quickly. I'll begin with the latest toll, more than 58,000 new cases, 407 deaths over the past 24 hours, new highs really, higher even than the first lockdown. There's growing talk of a new national lockdown. We heard the Labour Party leader say that in our report as well. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there has to be a new national lockdown. And once again, all the government has done so far is cause us to ask, when will they wake up and smell the coffee? The doctors are saying it. The other parts of the United Kingdom, the nations are saying it. England has to say it too. And every day that goes by that they don't have a national lockdown, except for essential things like work, will be more lives lost.
And of course, a national lockdown announced by the Scottish First Minister earlier today as well. Limbed Opik, thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Two other stories now. This one about a Spanish-flagged humanitarian ship seeking a port of safety Sunday for 265 migrants its crew rescued from the Mediterranean Sea in the last few days. Spanish NGO Open Arms Charity tweeted Saturday that 19 of its passengers, mainly from Eritrea, among them two women and 17 minors, were suffering from hypothermia. In a separate tweet, the organization said some 169 of the passengers had been rescued from a flimsy wooden boat left adrift in international waters. Prior to this, Open Arms Charity accused European governments of frequently abandoning refugees and migrants who often embark on perilous journeys through the Mediterranean to reach European shores. Norwegian police have found seven bodies after a massive landslide destroyed homes in the city of Ask near the capital Oslo.
Search teams with dogs, aided by helicopters and drones with heat-detecting cameras, are looking for the missing. Local police say the chances of finding anyone alive are fading. At least 1,000 people were faced to evacuate their homes by the worst landslide to have hit Norway in modern history. 2020 may be remembered as one of the worst years in recent human memory, but especially so for Iraq. The country has been forced to adapt to fight corruption, foreign aggression, and the pandemic. But as Robert Carter finds out, despite all their challenges, the Iraqis are holding together.
Faced with a new deadly virus threat, Iraq's vulnerable citizens have found themselves in a new war for survival, only this time against an invisible enemy. But many in Iraq are not turning towards the state for help, rather seeking aid and guidance from the religious authorities, including the Atiba administrations of the Holy Shia Shrines and Iraq's Grand Ayatollahs, particularly Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani.
As you surely realize from your visit to Atiba, Ayatollah Sistani has improved on his already achieved successes. We now have centers in the religious seminaries which sponsor learning and invest in scientific education. It is he who helps people learn how to become more educated in medicine.
One of the areas which the Atiba has invested heavily in is the medical infrastructure here in Iraq. For example, these hospitals which you see dotted around the major cities in the country have been playing a major role in supporting all types of Iraqi people, including widows of fallen fighters who died fighting against terrorist groups such as Daesh, and also helping families who have been fighting back against the COVID-19 outbreak.
Since the arrival of COVID-19, Iraq's clerical elite have mobilized at breakneck speeds, setting up new hospitals and COVID treatment centers across the country. Karbala's Zain al-Abidin Hospital is a newly built, state-of-the-art medical facility which caters for much of the local community's needs. Much of the funding for these anti-COVID facilities has come from the Atiba organization, which manages the Imam Hussein Grand Masjid. But their support doesn't end here. The Shrine factions have been investing heavily in the education sector too, to train a new generation of professionals in the field of medicine.
The university attracts distinctive students with all types of specialities and without discriminating against gender. The best are working here to teach sciences of many types. We manage the process of learning until the students graduate and can go and serve the community.
There are a lot of students at the University of Al-Kafil and the University of Al-Amin that are fully paid from the Al-Abbasi Holy Shrine here.
But it isn't just in Karbala where the scholars have rallied. Over in Najaf, I found that more clerical elites are spearheading their own projects too.
We have two projects with UN support. The first is related to helping Iraqi women, including the young, who receive abuse in society. The second helps to protect refugees from the